Hello and welcome to episode 83 of the Righteous Honourable podcast. My name is Jimmy Nichols and as per usual I'm joined by Jazza, but this time from the US. Jazza, how are you?
Fine, thank you. I won't do the accent, I'm sorry. hi, I'm great. I'm really good. I've been taking part in like a cultural exchange tour where I've been meeting up with the National Rifle Association. I saw Donald Trump speak. Did some stuff around Orlando and the Pulse anniversary that's coming up. I'm just having a lovely time. The inner geek in me is constantly ecstatic.
I'm sorry,
I say inner geek, the outer geek as well.
You actually saw Donald Trump speak?
I actually saw Donald Trump speak. I was in the front bloody row. It was him, marching band, me.
Wow. So you were what, 20 foot from him or something like that?
Less, yes. And I'm so sorry that I didn't take the opportunity, everybody.
Wow, that's strong. Already a joke about assassinating the US president.
To say hello. What are you trying to say?
Okay, yeah, fine. That's
all I wanted to do was shake his hand. I don't know what you're talking about.
What is he like actually seeing in the flesh? I know there's a lot of it.
There is a lot of it. He's more orange in the flesh, if you can imagine that.
Wow, that is...
somebody needs to really have some words with him. And it was for the Memorial Day stuff, so it was quite reserved. Here's a story about a man who died. Here's a story about another man who died. Everybody clapped for his wife. China.
That was probably about as coherent as the actual speech, I'm guessing.
It really was. It was fascinating. I'm sure people have already started these, but somebody really needs to write like a book about his syntax because it is fascinating. So at one point he said, we will remember these people for 1,000 years. And I was like, only 1,000?
No more though. Like, they won't be interesting after 1,000 years.
Yeah, I'll call in 3017 and see if we're still remembering or if Donald Trump actually has put an end to all of this remembering that we have to do.
Well, there has been some speculation that his scattered verbal style is actually evidence of early onset dementia or just extreme stress and fatigue.
Yeah, I'm kind of... Well, fatigue. He's been golfing an awful lot. But I'm kind of skeptical of the people that keep on like diagnosing him with mental illnesses and stuff like Alzheimer's. I don't think that stuff should be used lightly.
It's a bit sketchy, but the only thing I would say is that there's kind of video footage of him being interviewed back in the 80s where he's far more articulate and it's a complete contrast, really. And I think that does lend some credibility to the idea. I mean, plus his age in general.
But also Fox News destroys brain cells, so...
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there is also that. aside from the US president, what exactly are we going to be talking about on this podcast, Jazza?
So actually, I'm sure Trump will come up because it's 2017. We're going to be talking about this election thing that's happening this week in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland land. We're going to the polls on Thursday, the 8th of June, and we're going to be electing a completely new parliament to Westminster. And it's gotten very tense and exciting, hasn't it?
Has it?
Right. But this was meant to be like Theresa May called this because she was then going to end up getting a super easy majority. She was going to be able to govern as she wished. She was going to be able to destroy the NHS. Have a Brexit that worked for everybody. It was just going to be a walkover, and it was kind of going to be like the death of democracy. For the next 5 years. That's kind of bad to say. That's something that somebody told me today. And I should be fairer to the Conservatives. Like, strong and stable is a very resonant message if they weren't so wibbly-wobbly.
Is it fair to say that you're a bit sceptical about the Theresa May government at this point?
You know what they will be able to do? Like, if they get a, if they were getting the thumping majority that everybody expected them to get at the beginning of this process, then they would have been reasonably strong and stable. The problem is, Theresa May isn't strong enough a prime ministerial candidate to kind of carry the whole weight of the Conservatives on her shoulders, unfortunately. And we'll talk about this in terms of like her history as the Home Secretary and all that kind of stuff. But like the squeeze in the polls, the tightening of the polls is fascinating because nobody assumed this to happen.
I would say, though, that one factor in the polls that appears to have been underemphasized is that the Tories are actually polling, if you take an average poll of polls, higher than they were when Theresa May called the general election. The tightening is really entirely from Labour gains, basically.
Yeah, totally.
But that does contrast with this whole idea that Theresa May is a weak candidate. I know that her press performances have not been good, but she's actually still got a very, very high, or the Tories in general have a high poll rating as it goes.
No, that is true, and thank you for shitting all over my theory.
It's not just your theory, though. It is. The general talk in the newspapers, and particularly on social media, which is a terrible gauge for anything, has been that Theresa May is struggling, that she's panicking, that the Tories are in chaos. But when you sit back and look at the poll numbers, and particularly compare them to what they've been historically this year and last year, the Tories aren't doing that badly, really. And if anything, they're doing, I'm just looking at the polling history, they're doing, I think, the best they've been, aside from a spike sort of throughout May that subsequently came down. They're doing better than they have been doing for the past 2 years.
And certainly better than under David Cameron in 2015.
Yeah, I think so. Do you know what
he was on 35. He was on 35, I think ended up polling at 36 to get the seats that he had here.
Okay. So I'm thinking that despite the press that Theresa May's got in the past couple of weeks, the Tories are actually probably looking at still quite a substantial majority if you take the averaging of the polls as the best indicator of what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Sure? You don't believe me, or you just don't?
Yeah, so that's the podcast for this week.
Oh dear. So what else are we going to talk about if not the inevitable victory of the Conservative Party?
We're going to loop this in with the London attacks that happened on Saturday. Which is a little bit crazy because, so this one was like both Manchester. So I used to live in Manchester. I used to live like a block away from, I'm already talking in Americanisms. I used to live like a 5 minute walk away from the MEN stadium. And this time at London Bridge, a group of my friends were at London Bridge. They were in Borough Market when this happened, and they were barricaded in a restaurant for the majority of the night.
Jesus.
To be honest, I was the one worried. They were the one having a lovely time taking selfies in a bunker, essentially. And I was like, can you not stop making this trivial? We're going to be talking about how that has really turned into something it's political ammunition for both sides now, especially as it happened less than a week away from the election. I'm surprised that the election wasn't postponed, but it's not going to be. So
that wasn't even, the idea of it being postponed, the election, wasn't even on my radar when I was watching these attacks take place and when I was reading the news the morning after. I just didn't see that as a possibility at all, but you thought that might take place.
I think the manner in which, I mean, we'll talk about this more later, but the manner in which it has been used by mainly Labour and the Conservatives, and actually everybody else to bash the Conservatives, to be completely honest, the way that the death of like half a dozen people has been turned into like a way of clobbering Theresa May, I think is kind of distasteful. And it would have been a lot more sensible and a lot more measured, I think, to postpone it, to let people not have this as like the major thing at the top of their mind, because we have to elect a government for 5 years, not for like the week that we've ended up having two really horrific terrorist attacks.
But wouldn't that be seen in some ways as letting the terrorists win, where they've, you know, the attack has been effective to the extent that it's resulted in a general election being postponed?
If a general election were not were being called off, then yes, but postponing it, I think, actually sounds quite sensible.
I mean, I think we might as well start with the London attacks and how it's been politicised, and then sort of discuss some of the leaders' debates and that sort of thing. Because
yes, basically, I also just need you to break down what's happened with the leadership debates, because it's very difficult to find these things on the internet afterwards when you're not in the United Kingdom.
Are you sure? Because I watch the leaders' debates on YouTube.
I am lying. But it's just more effort, you know. It's more effort, you know. Like, I wasn't able to sit down and watch it live.
Yeah, I hear they don't even have YouTube in the United States. It's grim.
Yeah,
out there.
It's like really bad. Yeah. Trumpian politics and censorship.
Okay, so with the London attacks, how much do you think security and terrorism will actually be at the forefront of people's minds as they go into vote on Thursday?
So I don't think that the attacks themselves will be, but what has come out of the end of these attacks with the attacks on police numbers, on the cuts to frontline services of the police, and the fact that that was Theresa May's brief between 2010 and 2015, I think is very is very charged. And it's like, these attacks happened because it's Theresa May's fault. And I don't think that that is the case. It wasn't like frontline police services in London, at least. I don't know what it was in the Manchester attack. But in London, they had a response time of like
eight minutes,
yeah. Something like that. Yeah. And the perpetrators were dead within 8 minutes. I don't think that that shows a lack of forces. Like, what could they have done in 6 minutes that they couldn't have done in eight?
We should say, actually, because we didn't really summarise the attack for people who have not been following it very closely. What happened was that three attackers drove a van sort of down the street, hitting pedestrians, and then jumped out the van. This was around London Bridge, and then ran into Borough Market with knives and killed. I think the
Borough Market being like a big like lots of restaurants, lots of bars.
Yeah, basically, yeah, like a food and drinks place. And yeah, I think they killed seven people and injured about 50 more. And then, as Jazza says, the police arrived very promptly and then killed them. I think 50 bullets were actually fired, which will not sound like an awful lot to Americans, but bullets pretty much never get fired by policemen in the UK.
Yeah.
So that's an awful lot of bullets. So I do kind of, on the broader point of Theresa May's record, I think it is kind of tasteless in a way to connect her actions directly to this terror attack. And what people really should be thinking about is whether, you know, police cuts or police policy actually raises or lowers the general risk of terrorist attacks, because ultimately you can never reduce that risk to zero. All you can do is decide how many resources you're willing to expend on, you know, mitigating that risk.
Yeah, there's a lot of conversation about like it being the new normal, but then when you end up having we're never going to be able to 100% stop terrorist attacks happening, you know? But then when you have two in as many weeks, it's like, oh God, how many of these have to actually happen?
Yeah, I guess so. But, you know, it sounds like a slightly tasteless comparison, but in general terms, that for the amount of, you know, media bandwidth that is focused on terrorism, the amount of people that are, you know, that are actually injured or harmed in terrorist attacks is vanishingly low in the general scheme of things. And, you know, obviously, I kind of said this last week when we were discussing the Manchester attacks, but on some level, it is just a crime problem. It's a crime problem that is very, very difficult to mitigate against, and it's a lot more complicated necessarily than other problems. But you're far more likely just to get murdered generally, but probably by someone you know, because most cases of murder do involve people that know one another, than you are to be killed in a terrorist attack. But we end up talking about terrorism far more. So, I mean, there is that whole thing. We haven't really contrasted Theresa May's time as Home Secretary against Jeremy Corbyn's general stance on terrorism in itself. So what's your view as to that?
Well, in terms of Corbyn's response, I think that he's actually come out of this politically very strong. Specifically the line where he said, "You can't protect the public on the cheap," I think is a very resonant line. I don't know, how do you feel like that his response has been taken in the UK?
I think there's a lot of sympathy for the idea that the Tories did cut back the police force, and Corbyn obviously is in a good position for that because he's pro-spending, but then you kind of wonder with Corbyn, what cuts would he actually be willing to sanction? You know, for him, it almost seems as though public spending is a good in and of itself, irrespective of what the actual effect is. And when you have limited resources, ultimately you have to decide where you're going to put them. And then, you know, there's been this Tory line about the magic money tree, which is good. What they've said is that Jeremy Corbyn thinks there's a magic money tree where you can just spend and spend and spend, and it doesn't really matter, which is kind of has a continuum of Margaret Thatcher's famous line that the trouble with socialism is at some point you run out of other people's money.
Do you think that resonates still, even though in the budgets Labour have more or less a pretty comprehensive way of how they're going to fund stuff, whereas the Conservatives had a lot more black holes?
I think the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which is this kind of sanctified think tank in the UK that reviews all of the budgets and economic...
sanctified is a good word for it.
Yeah, there's actually a really, really good Guardian article, if anyone's interested, which talks about the role of the Institute for Fiscal Studies in British politics. And it has reached this point where all of its pronouncements are taken as gospel. They're not just taken as somebody's opinion, which is...
Think tank.
Yeah, it's a, you know, think tank, the clue's in the name. But they've said that Labour's costings don't really add up. The Tories obviously decided not to bother producing costings for a lot of their policies.
Because they thought they could get away with it, right?
Yeah, well, there is this whole thing which Labour are still fighting against the perception that people have always had of them, which is that they're not good with money. And I haven't actually sort of dug into this, but there are people that... argue that Labour's fiscal record is in fact much better than the Tories. And if you assume that's the case, the reason for it is that the Tories have this kind of brand where people think, oh, the Tories are good with money, and therefore they have more leeway to be bad with money because people's actions tend to be judged against their reputation rather than their reputation by their actions. And obviously Corbyn has the baggage of being a socialist and you know, being very pro public spending anyway, so that is something that Labour has had to try and mitigate against. But on some level, I don't really get the sense that people are too worried about the deficit anymore. I mean, if you remember during the Cameron administration, the talk of the deficit and then the long-term economic plan and all of that stuff totally dominated any kind of fiscal thinking in the UK, and every type of fiscal discussion was framed against this backdrop of we have to take the deficit down, the deficit being the difference between the public spending for that given year and the revenues, i.e. money from tax and that sort of thing. That's how the whole discussion has been framed, but actually I'm not even sure that people are thinking about that anymore. They just want public services to improve, and I just don't get the sense that that's as salient as it once was.
But then, so this is very interesting that we started off talking about security and policing and we've ended up talking about economics, and it always comes back to economics. And unfortunately, partially because of the socialist history of the Labour Party and partially because of the fact that they presided over the financial crash in 2007, which is still very raw in a lot of people's minds, they can't shake this thing of that they cannot be trusted with money, no matter how many times you say that Labour had absolutely nothing to do with the global financial crisis. It wasn't Gordon Brown's policies that caused Fannie Mae to collapse in the United States. It was a global crisis. But it's stuck to them. And there's that kind of dishonesty on Labour's opponent side of being able to use this against them that I find very frustrating as a voter, because I know that people are going to find it compelling and they're going to be like, oh, I actually quite like the idea of nationalising all of the railways, but oh no, that I couldn't trust the Labour Party with my taxpayers' money.
I mean, on the kind of nationalisation point, I feel that there's some other people that think that nationalising something is a guaranteed way of making that particular public service good again. The railways is the one that seems to come up the most. But people also talk about renationalising the Royal Mail, which is the postal service in the UK. And that seems to me to be sort of the opposite kind of version of shabby thinking on people's part. You know, people just seem to have these kind of tribal associations with particular policies, and you know, it also feeds into the discussion around the NHS as well, which we've talked about, the whole privatisation argument there. From my point of view, there's stuff in the public sector that is managed well, there's stuff in the private sector that's managed well, and there's stuff that's managed badly in both of those sectors. So having an argument that is entirely hinged around privatisation versus public ownership just seems to me to be kind of stupid in that sense.
So that's kind of one of the binaries that I find kind of frustrating about Labour's rhetoric. And I guess, shall we at the end of this podcast reveal who we're voting for?
Yeah, we can do that.
Oh, exciting! That's the one thing that I find frustrating about Labour, is that there's that binary of public good, private bad. And so, for example, their policy is to privatise all railways, and I'm like, I don't think that all railways should be privatised. I think that they should be run properly and that the government should be able to compete for those contracts. But just saying that privatisation, that public ownership in itself is good and better, I think oversimplifies the whole issue. The same with NHS.
Yeah, I definitely think that. We should probably sort of wheel back slightly to the kind of policing issue on all of this.
I'm going to blame you for the segue.
with the policing thing, do you actually get the sense that the police are underfunded and that is something that needs to be dealt with, or do you think the argument is actually kind of irrelevant and that, you know, there is obviously a terrorist risk in the UK, but that's something that on some level we just have to accept?
So we had I can't remember the guy's name, a former police chief who came out in the last couple of days saying that although actual amount of bobbies on the beat of policemen in the streets hasn't reduced, that's been because the cuts have caused policemen and policewomen to have to increase the amount of hours that they are actually working, saying that they were being forced to do 16-hour shifts rather than 12, and all of the figures were kind of not falsified, but representative of the actual reality of what it's like to be an officer in the UK. A side note: I also have friends who are police officers. One of my friends who was formerly in the London Metropolitan Police and is now in Manchester, what two places to be in the last couple of weeks, right? He talks about how he's it's an incredibly stressful job. Although he has only been an officer during the coalition and under a Tory government, so he doesn't have that kind of comparison between previous administrations and now, but he certainly is around a lot of people that have said that the work is now, you're expected to do more for less. And the problem is, if policing turns into the kind of profession that nursing has turned into or teaching has turned into, where tons of people want to do those jobs but the pressures and the financial rewards for those jobs are too damn for it to be worth the effort, then we end up having a problem again. We end up having an industry, a sector that provides a very important public service that nobody wants to go into. And that's what I kind of worry about with continued stretching of the resources of policing. And that's why I think that Corbyn's message of you can't protect the public on the cheap is a very, very strong one.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said as well for the idea that you can make efficiency savings in a lot of fields if that's something that you want to do, but at some point there are no more efficiency savings left and you are cutting back on core services.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think there's a role for Corbyn's critique, even though I do think it's motivated in part by a belief that public spending isn't inherently good. But I mean, all of this, the discussion about, you know, privatisation and public ownership and the police and the NHS and everything else, and even actually this, the U-turn on the social care policy that the Tories went through last week, it all comes back really to the fact that we are not entirely sure how we're going to fund the welfare state going forward with an ageing population and all the rest of it. And I don't think anyone in British politics has provided a compelling answer for that question, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there's the answer that the Conservatives had, do you think that that is good enough though?
So wait, you in terms of social care policy?
Yes, yeah. In terms of how they're going to fund it.
In terms of specifically to social care, one of the biggest criticisms of the policy was that it effectively meant that if somebody fell ill with dementia in the last part of their life, they would end up paying a lot of their savings to actually cover the healthcare costs, whereas if they fell ill with cancer or something else, then they wouldn't be liable for those costs, which I think is a fair critique, and that's certainly my reading of the policy. It would probably be better to start discussing an inheritance tax, really.
Yeah, but that's never going to fly with a Tory party, is it?
The Tories are very unlikely to be the ones who champion the inheritance tax. What often happens in British politics is that progressive parties suggest ideas for how to improve things, and then the Tories eventually adopt those policies in order to win elections.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a chance that that might happen, but this is going to be something that... probably the Labour Party, but also I guess the Lib Dems and the SNP to a lesser extent, have to push in order for that to come through. But I mean, there's also arguments about just general fairness in society and the role of inheritance in social mobility that I think make an idea of an inheritance tax quite compelling. But you know, you also need to find sources of funding for social services at the end of the day.
What do you think about the, just to kind of wrap up the section that was meant to be about the London attacks, what do you think about the scrap that Trump and Sadiq Khan have gotten into?
So just to check that I've got this right, basically on the night of the terrorist attacks in London, which was the previous Saturday, Donald Trump was up and tweeting against Sadiq Khan. Sadiq Khan, the London mayor, who has previously been quoted saying that terrorist attacks are part and parcel of living in a big city in the West, which is true. and Donald Trump was like criticizing him and then also using the London attacks as a way of justifying his quote Muslim ban, or Muslim ban 2.0, which is the travel ban against you know, a number of mostly Muslim countries or residents of those countries entering the US. I mean, it is pretty disgraceful, but Donald Trump is a disgraceful person, so
yeah.
Why
do you remember what he said though? So Trump very deliberately, or was it deliberate? So interestingly, Trump quoted Sadiq Khan out of context. Sadiq said that we are going to increase the amount of armed police in your streets in the next few days in response to the attacks. There's no need to be alarmed, which sounds to me, and the and was clarified by his spokesperson later, that was very clearly a message to Londoners that they shouldn't be alarmed that there are more armed police on the streets. Trump then took, there's no need to be alarmed, said, seven people have died, 48 people have been injured, and the mayor, Sadiq Khan, says there's no need to be alarmed. That isn't what he said. But when what I actually, and so they've had like this to and fro, and I think that Sadiq Khan has actually been very good at kind of raising himself above this, and Donald Trump has been brilliant at making himself look like an absolute twazzock. So what I think has happened is that Trump didn't understand the whole text of what Sadiq said. I don't think he deliberately took it out of context. I just don't think he understood, because he's a bit thick.
Possibly. I mean, I think that might be being a bit generous to him.
Do you think? Oh, okay.
No one knows what goes on in that man's mind. So it's, or if anything goes on in that man's mind, to be honest with you. But it's, I don't know. I mean, I think Sadiq, you know, Khan has, you know, generally dealt with these sort of situations well. It should be said that I don't think the London mayor actually has that much control over the Metropolitan Police, so far as I'm aware. The London mayor's powers are mostly around transport.
Transport, housing, and he does have some powers over policing as
well. He does have some, but I think they're limited. But, you know, as a figurehead for Londoners, he's dealt with this quite well. And he's obviously a Muslim himself, so there's kind of another angle there. But yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a little bit bored of people getting offended by what Trump says, because, you know, it's sort of like getting it's like getting upset if your dog continually shits on the carpet. At some point you just have to accept that's what it's going to do. And I personally would hear a lot less from Trump if people on my Twitter feed stopped retweeting him.
So Jimmy, I've been absent for the past couple of weeks, and as such have kind of been somewhat detached from the conversations and the drama and the theatre of the political process, in terms of like the debates, the interviews, the televised stuff that has been happening. Basically, in the words of Craig David, can you fill me in?
I'm not sure these 90s references are going to get past all of our listeners.
I'll have you know that Craig David was early noughties.
I knew you were going to say that as soon as I said 90s. He's in the same filing cabinet in my head as the rest of the 90s.
Right, very well.
So what has happened roughly? What was the last thing that you watched? You watched a bit of the Andrew Neil interviews, I'm guessing.
Yes, yeah. That was the last thing that we talked about as well in last week's podcast.
So Andrew Neil has talked to Tim Farron now and Nicola Sturgeon, so the leaders of the Lib Dems and the SNP, and I think he's also talked to the UKIP leader, Paul Nuttall. And there was a round of question time with just general people from political parties, and there were these also, they were sort of termed debates, but they weren't really debates. They were Q&A sessions with Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn, but separately, because Theresa May has been unwilling to appear to debate Jeremy Corbyn face-to-face. I don't think we really learnt anything more from those kind of leadership interrogations, if you like, than we did from the Andrew Neil interviews. I think I assume most people are fairly decided on the leaders at this point. But if the only thing that you watched was the leadership Q&As, then they were kind of informative. I mean, it covered a lot of the obvious stuff. So just sort of looking back at my notes, Theresa May was criticised for calling the general election by the audiences in these were actually very, very hostile, and they asked some pretty damning questions. The Tories were criticised for their handling of the NHS over the past 7 years, and in particular they were criticised for their stance on mental health, although from my point of view there appears to be a consensus in British politics now that there needs to be more funding for mental health, and I don't think any of the major parties disagree with that. It's probable that the Labour would give them more money than the Tories, but that's kind of by the by. There was actually one point where Theresa May was obliged to defend foreign aid, and there was something that you might have seen on Twitter. So yeah, Theresa May was asked about why we have given £4 million to North Korea, which is this terrible repressive regime. And she basically defended it on the grounds that any sane person would defend foreign aid, and that, you know, obviously it's good for wealthier people to give money to less well-off people. It's, you know, it's good for those countries so long as it's managed well. It helps improve the governance of those countries, and it makes them more likely to develop civil institutions and become prosperous themselves. But I thought that was interesting in that, you know, Theresa May is often lambasted as this evil Tory. And, you know, the Tories still back quite a lot of things that are generally seen as good governance and, or, you know, as good policy. And one of them is a foreign aid budget. She was actually asked as well about just her hypocrisy over Brexit, how she turned from Remain to Leave so quickly. And I think she fell back on the defence of, you know, this is the will of the British people and all that sort of thing. I mean, none of that, I guess, sounds just out of line with what we've previously heard from her, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. So the main thing that was kind of on my radar all the way over here on the other side of the Atlantic was the leaders' debate that had the seven main parties.
Right, yeah.
Excluding Northern Ireland, where Nicola Sturgeon didn't turn up, but she did have the head of the Scottish National Party in Westminster, Angus Robertson, there as her representative, which I kind of like. I totally kind of understood, because this is a Westminster election anyway. Jeremy Corbyn last minute decided to rock up and then challenged Theresa May to turn up. Theresa May never turned up, and there was a furor on my like from what I could see, because she sent Amber Rudd, and I was thinking, have they sent Amber Rudd because she's also a lady, and if people are kind of squinting, they might just think it's Theresa May? Like, I wasn't 100% sure why.
So the only alternatives, I think, that they could have sent in place of Theresa May were Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary, and Philip Hammond, who's the Chancellor. Philip Hammond is not the world's most charismatic person, I think you could safely say.
Spoiler alert, neither is Amber Rudd.
Neither's Amber Rudd, but I think she's slightly more media-friendly than Hammond is. And Boris Johnson, I think there's obvious reasons why you wouldn't want to send Boris Johnson to represent you, particularly if your leadership credentials are looking a little bit shaky, if you want to put it that way. So, I mean, it's possible they said Amber Rudd just because she was a woman, but I think there's other strategic reasons why that would have made sense.
Yeah. What was kind of like the blowback from that? Because that looks damning to me, to have everybody there basically slating Theresa May without her being able to be present. It looked weak. It looked cowardly, to be completely honest. It kind of went against all of the things that she has been trying to tout. And that line that she always has of, I'd rather go out and talk to people on the doorstep rather than spending time in television studios, just didn't seem to fly this time. Yeah. For me, anyway.
Yeah, that, I mean, that is what she said, I think, during the question time Q&A session when she was just on her own. And, well, she described it as that debate as seven politicians arguing among themselves.
That's what politics is, Theresa.
Oh, well, I mean, it was more as you put it last week, I think this was when we were off air, there wasn't an awful lot of, there was more heat than light in that in that seven-way leadership debate. In fact, I think it was all heat. I don't really understand this fervor for televised leadership debates. I know that they're common in other democracies, but the fact that a lot of people do something doesn't mean that it works very well. If you just look at it, what's the quality of argument here? What's the quality of information that's being conveyed? And the answer is, it's fucking dog shit. I mean, it just is absolutely the biggest waste of everybody's time, these debates. Mm-hmm. And I understand why people have criticised Theresa May for not wanting to go on these things. And I actually, you know, it did make her look weak among a certain class of person, but I actually think most people probably don't really care. And the reason she didn't do them is because she doesn't fare well in them. And, you know, it's if she thought she had something to gain by doing them, she would have done them. I wouldn't assume that she was avoiding them out of the principle that they're not very good. But I personally think that an interview with a journalist who can press, you know, who can press a politician on certain points, who won't allow them to wriggle away from things, is far more interesting and far more useful in terms of information than any of these leadership debates are. I would say the Q&As are actually better than the debates as well. I actually think they're reasonably informative, and at least in the Theresa May, Jeremy Corbyn's ones this year, and I also think in the ones involving Ed Miliband, Nick Clegg and David Cameron in 2015, the audience did press them on a lot of points. Maybe that's a decent midpoint, because you get the democratic participation, but you also get good questioning. The head-to-head debates are on television are just crap, and people really should stop pretending that it's a good thing that we do them, because it just isn't. And I'd be amazed if anyone defended them on the grounds that they were good in terms of information.
So I don't think that they're necessarily always good on information, but I think that there is value in seeing your options up there represented by their leaders in one space, because then you can contrast them directly. And there's something interesting about the way that Theresa May has been, or initially started off as, this is Theresa May's team, strong and stable. Theresa May, May's team, strong, stable, May's team. But what we've ended up seeing, I think, is actually a leader that isn't very confident talking to the public, is a leader that has to flip-flop on policy once it's been announced in a manifesto, who is wary of debating people face-to-face, because and all of that bullshit of not being able to talk to people on the doorstep. She hasn't spoken to anybody on doorstep.
Yeah.
She's done like media bites and had people invited to speak to her so she can have an easy ride. And that goes completely against this idea of the second coming of the Iron Woman that she has been trying to kind of build herself up as. She actually seems, and especially in some of the clips that I've seen of the interviews that she's had with Andrew Neil and Paxman and all that kind of stuff, she seems quite nerdy, unsure of herself, unconfident, and I don't know how much of that is because of the what has happened to her in the polls for the last few weeks. But I'm seeing a much more deflated and less impressive Theresa May in this campaign than I have seen, for example, at Prime Minister's Questions every week when she speaks against Jeremy Corbyn.
I'd agree with that.
And I think that she is the big loser here. And if she doesn't do particularly well this week, then I think that she's going to, Boris will run. She'll be seen as this weak leader. If she ends up with only a couple more or even loses seats, the leadership of the Tory party is wide open, to be completely honest, because I think she's cocked up a bit.
She has, but bear in mind that it is actually still quite early in her premiership, and you might find that over time she, you know, starts to look more and more impressive. It is the case that she looks weaker now than she did when she first became Tory leader. But actually, the Tories are still polling quite well. As I said, that they've increased their poll numbers since the general election was announced, although obviously Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party are doing much better now, so the lead has narrowed, but they have actually increased their numbers. The Tories have increased their numbers in absolute terms. But I'd also kind of say that a lot of people said of Jeremy Corbyn when he was first elected Labour leader, yes, he's not a very impressive speaker, but we admire him for his principles, and isn't this focus on media presentation all a bit drab and a bit lacking in substance? And all of that really should still apply to Theresa May. The fact that she's not very good in front of the press, it doesn't necessarily mean very much. That there are a lot of contradictions in her leadership, and particularly her stance on Brexit is a bit incoherent, but you know, maybe we should probably still be judging her more by her record in office, which also isn't very impressive, but that is more substantial than, you know, just criticising her for being, you know, a bit anxious in front of a camera.
So Jimmy, have you decided yet who's going to get your vote?
I think we should. I went through like May's Q&A thing, so I think we should actually briefly.
Oh, do you want to do? Okay, fine.
We should cover Jeremy Corbyn, and then we can wrap up, and you can go do some fun Florida things or whatever it is you're about to do.
I'm about to record a video. Actually, there's going to be no fun Florida for me today.
That is sad. I think that Jeremy Corbyn, and you know, this is not an original observation, but he actually appears to have got very good at media recently, and he's been quite impressive throughout the campaigning season. And he wasn't previously. It's actually kind of mysterious as to why he's just suddenly improved massively. Contrast him with Theresa May. He just appears very comfortable on stage. He's willing to deal with questions on his weakness on foreign policy, which I think is still a massive liability for Labour in general. The fact that Jeremy Corbyn has been friendly with members of the IRA, and he has actually spoken on platforms with quite a few unsavoury kind of Islamic extremists, basically, and he has had a lot of links with those sorts of people. He also took money from he was paid for a stint on Iran's public broadcasting agency Press TV. He has a lot of dodgy links to anti-Western forces, and I still think that it's a general part of his thinking in terms of foreign policy that the West are the bad guys, and I think that's a major reason not to vote for him. But he's actually fairly decent at dealing with those sort of questions now. And if you still don't like him for those reasons, you're not going to be impressed with his answers. But he's not flustered by it. He just sort of deals with it and he moves on. Did you hear this whole thing? This appeared to be the main thing that people picked up on Jeremy Corbyn's Q&A. The kind of nuclear question, did that kind of pop up on your radar at all?
No, not really. Go on.
So basically he was asked if he'd ever be willing to fire nuclear weapons. And the sense with Corbyn is that the answer is basically no. But he was not willing to say really one way or the other. The strongest statement he gave on it was that he would decide based on the circumstances at the time whether he was willing to fire nuclear weapons. And progressives on Twitter, at least, seem to be very, very amused by this, and they said, "Oh, what is it with all these people who want to drop a nuclear bomb on somebody else? What's the point if we've been nuked? Then what does it matter?" But obviously, the point of a nuclear weapons deterrent is that you have to say you're willing to fire it, even if you're not. And it seems to me that he managed to fudge his stance on the EU for the sake of campaigning, or barely campaigning for the Remain in the EU referendum. I just don't see why he doesn't take the Tim Farron option and just lie about his point of view at this point. Just say, yeah, I would fire a nuclear weapon. I'd be willing to fire a nuclear weapon. And
because he's an honest man. And then actually that would turn off a lot of his core base.
He's not an honest man though. He clearly wanted to leave the EU, or clearly wasn't convinced by it, by remaining at least. And yet he still campaigned just about on the Remain side. He lied about meeting the IRA as well. He is a liar, like Theresa May. Both of the people who The two people who are most likely to be prime minister next week are both proven liars.
Newsflash.
Yeah, I mean, you could say politicians lie, but these people have been caught out on very obvious lies, which I think is kind of dispiriting. But yeah, I mean, I think that Corbyn has certain strengths, a lot of which appeal to his public base. But he did talk interestingly on the question of migration. He acknowledged the massive contribution of migrants to British society, but he also said that he would target firms that recruit solely from overseas, and he also said he would invest more money in training for low skilled and unskilled workers in Britain, which would open the jobs market up for them. Which I think are both quite sensible policies, really. And then he also went on a little bit about zero-hour contracts, which I find a bit of a red herring, given that most of the people who are on 0 hour contracts are happy with the number of hours they get. But you know, that appears to, that has been one of the big bêtes noires of progressives for, you know, a little while now, so it's not too surprising that that sort of thing came up. But yeah, in general terms, he did quite well. Are you going to be voting for him?
No, I. So Jimmy, have you decided who you're going to vote for on Thursday? As if I haven't asked you that question before and you didn't shoot me down. I've asked you now. You answer. You first.
All right. So
and actually, you know what? My answer is no. I'm not going to be voting for him because I'm not in his constituency.
Psych. All right. So this is going to be a roundabout way of answering your question.
Yes.
But I will.
I'm going to hate you, aren't I?
I will endeavour to give you an answer by the end of this ramble. My problem is that I voted for Brexit, and I basically would like a hard Brexit because I don't think a soft Brexit is a real Brexit. As in, I think if you retain access to the single market and you have to abide by all their rules, and if you continue to sit under the European Court of Justice. If you take the Norway option or something similar to the Norway option or even the Swiss option, which is a load of bilateral treaties and is very complicated but amounts to something vaguely similar, then I don't think you've left the EU. And I think for the referendum vote to be honoured in any meaningful way, then it has to be a hard Brexit. And I personally don't see the point of a soft Brexit. I think if you're going to argue for a soft Brexit, just remain in the EU. I mean, just it doesn't make any sense to me. So that makes supporting the Lib Dems, whose domestic policies and general outlook I quite like, difficult, because the Lib Dems want to overturn the EU referendum. They never say quite as much, but if you watched Andrew Neil's interview or even just a few clips of him discussing Brexit with Tim Farron, it's obvious that there's just an intellectual incoherence to the Lib Dems' position on this particular question, and that makes it hard to vote for them. With Jeremy Corbyn, I'm unconvinced by some of his domestic policies, but the main problem with Labour for me is that, or I suppose my main problem with Corbyn per se, is that his leadership team is filled with delinquents, frankly. John McDonnell, Diane Abbott, neither of those people should be in office, I don't think, or at least in the cabinet office, or on the cabinet. And I don't agree with Jeremy Corbyn's view that the West are the bad guys of history, which, you know, I think that's the inference that you can take from his stance on the Falklands and the IRA and all the rest of it. Those are my problems with the Labour Party. The problem with the Tories is that I agree with them on Brexit, but I think Theresa May is not a terribly good leader necessarily. I think that there's some authoritarian tendencies in the Tory party which I massively disagree with, particularly the Snoopers Charter, which was smuggled through I think it was sometime in the last year, and actually gives surveillance powers to the police over internet communications. And there's talk of doing more of that in the wake of the London attacks. None of that I particularly agree with. I don't really agree with the broad Tory view that people who work hard get rewarded in a capitalist economy. I think it tends to be people that already have privilege that get rewarded in a capitalist economy, or at least in the one that we currently have. So I actually identify more with Labour on that particular issue. And, you know, there's a bunch of other, like the whole fox hunting thing on the Tory side as well is pretty questionable, I think. The idea that they're going to have a free vote to bring it back. So the short answer to your question, Jazza, is that I don't really want to vote for any of them, because there are red lines for me that they've all crossed. So at this point, I don't know.
Dramatic.
I don't know.
That was a dramatic pause.
But I don't think I'll vote Labour. If I do decide not to support my ballot, it will either be a vote for the Tories for their Brexit stance or for the Lib Dems for their stance on most everything else. And I live in a Tory safe seat, so the question is frankly academic at this point. But yeah, that's my answer. So what's yours?
Well, I'll be interested to tune in as everybody else does next week. once we have the result to find out how you did actually vote. That'd be fun.
Mm.
So am I expected to also do a little bit of a rambly thing as you did?
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to do a tour of all the parties, but you you probably should at least say what you like about the party you are going to vote for.
Yeah, so I, as an individual, and as I think an awful lot of people, especially young people, actually the public at large have an issue with defining a party by their leader and by their public presentation. And actually, at the end of the day, that's one of the least important things when it comes to choosing who to vote for. There's been an awful lot of juxtaposition between Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn, how Tim Farron, his views on gay marriage and homosexuality,
and
the Greens,
well.
and like all of that religious shite. It's been very difficult actually to cut through all of that kind of like personality politics and actually focus on the policies that are going to end up being governed in the next 5 years or however many years, because the Conservatives want to repeal the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. I was raised by Tories. There are a lot of things about the Conservative Party that I agree with and that I can get on board with. The protection of smaller businesses, making it easier for people to be able to make their own businesses and to build wealth and to protect their families and all those kinds of things. A sensible, balanced economy. All of that I can get on board with, but with this ideology of reducing to the state to the point where our public services are being stretched and frankly decimated by the lack of money that's actually going into them, I cannot vote Conservative with a clean conscience in order to do that. Labour, Jeremy Corbyn aside, I actually think he as an individual would be an okay Prime Minister. What would end up being quite difficult would be the inevitable media furor that kind of surrounded him afterwards, and the amount of attacks that he as an individual would end up getting whilst in power. I want a Prime Minister to be, for want of a better word, strong and stable, and to look like they belong in the job. And I don't think that Jeremy Corbyn would be able to do that for a long time, but I don't want it to be about that. I look at the policies of the Labour Party and I see a lot of stuff that broadly I kind of agree with. Nationalisation of certain public services and showing that increasing spending. I think it's time for us to increase spending and invest not just our public services but the country, but there is too much binary there, and they're just essentially the same coin, the different side of the same coin to the Conservatives. The Conservatives want to reduce spending and privatise stuff just for ideology's sake. It doesn't matter whether it works or not. And Labour want to bring everything into public ownership regardless of whether it works or not, just because it's ideological and it's the best thing to do. I'm not allowed to vote SNP. I'd probably end up voting SNP if I were in Scotland. The Greens, I love Caroline Lucas. I don't think that there's anybody that doesn't love Caroline Lucas. But the Greens, when they have gotten into power, have proved themselves incompetent in being able to be a cohesive political force. I would not want to vote Green. My party, the Lib Dems, are the people that on paper I agree with the most, and the people that I have the most in common with in terms of pure policy. I am not a big fan of our leader. Again, this is a running problem. I too, Jimmy, hate them all.
Will just be drawing a large penis on your voting slip.
So when it comes to the Lib Dems, they are my people. I think that they've picked the wrong way of going about the Brexit referendum. You know that I'm a hardcore Brexitomaniac, but I think that their messaging has been kind of shit. They picked the wrong battle this election.
I don't think it's a problem with messaging as such. I just think the principles are bad. I think that the policy is bad. The policy of seeking a second referendum, quote unquote, on the terms is, you know, it's just silly. It's just nonsensical.
I disagree with you on that, but that's fine. I still love you. the thing is also. We, Jimmy, are also, to use a metaphor again, two sides of the same coin. I'm in a hyper safe Labour seat, so it doesn't actually really matter how I vote. And every single time that I voted, I have had this thought process in terms of thinking, like, what I want and what I think is the biggest issue for me. In terms of long-term democracy in this country, is having a more representative democracy that does away with safe seats, that allows people to have a local MP that represents them no matter how they voted. And in that sense, like a party that backs proportionate representation or something along those lines, is a party that is going to tickle my fancy. Labour want to have proportionate representation. So right now I'm torn between being a millennial and getting on the Corbyn wagon, and voting with my bros in the Lib Dems, and continuing to sing "The Only Way Is Up, Baby."
So you also don't know how you're going to be voting?
I need to find out I need to figure it out before, in the next like 6 hours.
Yeah.
Because my brother is proxy voting for me, and he's doing it in the morning. And he was like, "Oh, if you don't tell me by the morning, then I'm not going to vote for you." And I'm like, "Oh, thanks, mate. Cheers."
I've still got 24 hours or so. 24 hours.
Yeah.
Dropping a text.
I've still got some time.
Yeah.
I have some time.
It'll be fine.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. It has been.
But also, penis is an option.
Yeah. I mean, that'll be an interesting. He'll probably go through with that, I'd have thought. He probably will draw a penis on the
ballot
paper
for you.
Oh, he'll love
that.
Yeah.
At his heart, he's still a 14-year-old boy, and I love him for it.
Yeah. So, I think we've fairly discussed the various parties and their pros and cons.
Mainly cons, let's be fair. We're pessimistic bastards, aren't we?
I mean, I'm skeptical about saying that this has been, you know, the worst election ever in terms of leadership candidates, because I think people have a tendency to, you know, hype up the bad parts of the current situation and forget about those parts in previous elections. But it is quite a lackluster.
Hyperbole is a fun poetic device to use in everyday discourse, right?
It is fun. I mean, all the candidates suck. You probably live in a safe seat, so it doesn't even matter how you vote. I'd say
I found out it's 360 seats. The outcome has already been decided. Like the Electoral Commission has already gone like, "Oh yeah, this is a Labour seat. This is going to be Tory."
I'm certain that I'm in one of those seats.
Same.
So yeah.
I can't tell people to not vote. Like, it goes against every fibre of my being, and I think that the election this time around is so consequential, because whoever gets to run the country as we leave the European Union basically gets to write all of the things that end up being consequential and lawful in this country for decades to come. Whoever wins this election ends up being able to shape the nation and its future for a very long time, not just the next parliament. And if you end up not voting in it, quite frankly, you can go bugger off. Because if you can't see how consequential this is, if you listen to this podcast and you're not voting, we can no longer be friends. Although, do still continue to leave us ratings and reviews.
I think what we need actually is like a sort of Dream Team Cabinet option, whereby when you go and vote, you can just pick particular politicians from each party and just come up with, you know, a dream team. I think that would be a good thing.
Oh my god. If there's a hung parliament, which is possible, and we have like a few days before like shit gets organized. Can we do that next week?
I fear there won't be a hung parliament, but yeah, we'll do that if the opportunity arises.
Can I call the election, seeing as I'm a medium?
Yeah, I guess so. This is your reference to the fact that you managed to call the Trump and the Brexit votes before they actually happened.
Yeah. So okay. I and also Macron.
Everyone called saying. Macron. Okay, that's not a claim.
Yeah,
to
I know,
fame.
But it, don't take this away from me. I'm going to call for a conservative's largest number of seats, shy of a majority.
So you don't think the Tories will be able to form a majority government? They'll either have to do a minority government or form a coalition of some sort.
I think so, yeah.
I actually think there will be a conservative majority, and I think it will be in the region of like 30 to 80 seats, let's say. So like they'll have
which is basically what they had in 2010 to 2015 with the coalition, right? That's them about the majority.
Yeah, something like that. But it'll be a larger majority than the one they went in with, but it won't be that much larger. It won't be a crazy landslide, I don't think. So yeah, those are our predictions, such as they are. So
you know, we are such mediums.
We are. We can be proven wrong now. But yeah, go and vote. You probably should. You should probably vote, even if. You know, at least for the candidate you hate the least. And if you hate them all equally, then spoil your ballot paper. Show them what for.
That'll tell them.
We should probably wrap this up now.
Okay. Love you all very much. Jimmy, I love you the mostest.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you next week when we have a new parliament.
We will do. Or maybe we won't have... Well, we'll have a new parliament, but no new government.
Yeah, no, we won't. We will definitely have a new... Yeah. Yeah. Don't take this away from me.
Sorry. All right, then. Bye-bye.
All right. Uluru.